From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. On Friday, President Obama took time out to highlight one piece of the White House budget that's coming out today. He calls it the Precision Medicine Initiative, a push away from one-size-fits-all medicine and toward personalized medicine. Your genes, your lifestyle, your personalized treatment. It can sound like magic. Is it the future? This hour on Point, the new push for personalized medicine and how far it can go. Later in this hour, we will look at the sudden return of measles to the USA and how it's hitting the anti-vaccination movement. But first to personalized medicine. The president was happy to talk about it in his State of the Union address.
I want the country that eliminated polio and mapped the human genome to lead a new era of medicine. One that delivers the right treatment at the right time.
And what will we call that?
Something called precision medicine. In some cases, people call it personalized medicine. It gives us one of the greatest opportunities for new medical breakthroughs that we have ever seen.
The president there at the White House on Friday, eager to talk about what he calls a bipartisan push on this new front. Joining us now from Bethel, Connecticut, is Ron Winslow. He covers health and science for the Wall Street Journal. Ron, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here, Tom. Thanks very much.
Why this push by the White House now?
Well, I think we're really at an inflection point in the science of genetics. We had the genome project that was done, completed 10 or 12 years ago. A lot of people expected miracles to happen right away. It's taken a while. We've got the power of this genetic science. We've got cheaper and cheaper sequencing. We got powerful technology that can store it, and I think there's just kind of a perfect storm of good things that really is teeing this up to make some headway against disease.
What are the main pieces of this new push, this initiative, the Precision Medicine Initiative, Ron?
Well, I think one of the main pieces is really is happening particularly in cancer, where we have growing understanding of that tumors have a genetic basis, and we are able to identify those specific mutations and try to match drugs that are either on the market or in development to those mutations to have an effective treatment. So one of the main areas is trying to take a person's genetics or a tumor's genetics, in this case, match it with a potentially workable medicine and improve outcomes.
They're talking about tracking the genetics of 1 million Americans to look for patterns that might lead to these precision therapies. Who will those million be? Are those new volunteers? Or do those include people who are already being studied? Who are they? Will they be?
Yeah, I think they're going to look for, I think there's probably 10 or 20,000 people who have been sequenced so far, so they'll be looking for a lot of new people to join this cause. The president, I think, said they're looking for volunteers. I suspect he won't have any trouble, or the NIH won't have any trouble finding them. There's a great deal of interest in some quarters for people to contribute to this sort of idea and to get a better understanding of their own genetics.
John, would you do it, Ron? I mean, after all, if you do it, you're going to have your genetics all laid out. I guess they won't be looking at them individually, but you never know how that works out. Would you throw your genetic code into this pool?
I think I probably would. I think that would be an interesting thing to do. Of course, there's some of my colleagues in the covering medicine have done this already and written extensively about it and powerfully about it. How it would work, I don't know, but I think it would be a good thing to contribute to this idea because the more data they have and the increasing ability to analyze it, I think will help push the whole field forward.
It's a $215 million request for this initiative. That's not gigantic in terms of the federal budget, but it's a real investment. What's the level of optimism you're picking up on, Ron? You cover healthcare all over the place. Do people think this has great potential? I mean, after all, we've heard about it for a long time, as you say. The story just a couple of years ago was, where's the beef? It hasn't delivered. And some people are looking at what people describe as the drying up of the pipeline for more conventional drugs and wondering if this is like the pharmaceutical industry looking desperately for a new frontier.
Well, it certainly has been it's a major focus of the pharmaceutical industry. This area and the immune system is which also has some precision medicine elements to it, they are certainly seeing this as a huge opportunity going forward. It has some interesting dilemmas because most of the drugs that are now on the market, there are a handful that are already on the market that attack these mutations, and they're very expensive. So one of the challenges going forward is going to be how we pay for this kind of innovation. It's going to definitely put some pressure on that score as we keep trying to control healthcare costs. Although certainly companies also argue that if there's a great value in really effective treatments, so that's going to be a good part of the national debate that's triggered by this initiative.
How to pay for it, a big deal once you get different drugs for all kinds of different groups of people or individual people. Ron Winslow with The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks very much, Tom.
Let's turn to the National Institutes of Health for a minute. They will be right in the middle of this if it rolls out. With us right now from Bethesda, Maryland, is the NIH Director, Dr. Francis Collins. Dr. Collins, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Hi, Tom. I'm a fan of your program. Nice to be with you.
Thank you very much. It's great to have you. What will the NIH role in this initiative, if it all gets green-lighted, what will it be?
It'll be very substantial. We are, after all, the largest supporter of biomedical research in the country, in fact, in the world. And we very much are excited about the potential of this initiative to move forward what has been an exciting idea, but it hasn't been really tackled at scale in the way that this initiative promises to do.
So what makes you think that we can make the breakthrough now?
Well, as Ron was saying a few minutes ago, it is an opportunity where a number of things have all come together in the last couple of years that really weren't in place before. First of all, the idea of being able to determine large amounts of information about an individual's genome, your DNA mm-hmm. instruction book, was too expensive to contemplate doing on a large scale until fairly recently. But the cost has just been plummeting thanks to a lot of technology development. So that first human genome that cost us hundreds of millions of dollars, now yours and mine can be done for a couple thousand. And that makes this kind of effort more practical than it would have been. On top of that, we have electronic health records now present in most hospitals and medical centers that makes it easier to be able to connect up your DNA information with your medical history. We have a lot of interesting technologies to monitor people's health using cell phone-based sort of wearable sensors to measure all sorts of things about you when you're walking around, which may be a good way to prevent illness or to monitor the management of chronic disease. So you put all that together, plus a general increasing interest on the part of the public in finding out these kinds of details about their own health, the empowered generation that wants to be part of their own medical care. And it sounds like this is the moment to move this forward. It's particularly so for cancer, as Ron was saying, because we've made really big strides in understanding cancer in the last few years because of the ability to use DNA analysis, but it's time to ramp that up too.
Ramp up on lots of fronts here. Does this mean that what we're doing currently in medicine is crude, broad-stroke stuff? Will we look back in, 20 years and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe we weren't more finely focused?
Well, medicine does, fortunately, move forward with more and more science and more evidence to guide decision-making, and this, I think, could be a major contribution to that. It's not to say that we have been ignoring personalized medicine all along. If you needed a blood transfusion, even many decades ago, you'd want to be sure that the unit of blood you got was appropriate for you, that it was your blood type. But for most areas of medicine, we haven't really had the information to go from one size fits all to something that's more appropriate for the individual. That day is dawning now, and genomics has had a big role there, but not the only role. and it's time to see if we could, in a very large-scale research-based effort, demonstrate how to do this and prove to ourselves and to anybody who wants to see that it's actually going to improve outcomes. It's one thing to say it's a nice idea. We actually have to collect the data.
And what about the cost structure of this future if it unfolds as people hope? We know what the costs are of developing new drugs today. If you have to develop new drugs for every individual person or little cluster of people, it can sound daunting.
It can, but you know, actually, this may work in the other direction, and wouldn't that be a good thing? First of all, having this kind of detailed information about the molecular basis of illness, whether we're talking about Alzheimer's disease or autism or diabetes or cancer, allows you to pinpoint the actionable spots in a disease pathway more precisely, which means that if you're going to develop a drug, you have a better chance it's actually going to work. One of the reasons that making drugs right now is so expensive is because almost all of them fail by the time you get to that final clinical trial. If we could increase the success rate just a little bit, that would be hugely helpful in terms of what is otherwise a prodigiously expensive process. The other thing that will help is if you are designing a drug and you know precisely of the people with that disease who have the particular characteristics that are likely to respond, you can run a clinical trial with far fewer people than we used to have to do, where you pretty much didn't know who it was going to work for, so you had to enroll thousands and thousands of people. Again, this could reduce the cost of developing and proving that drugs work and getting them FDA approved.
Francis Collins, we've just got a few more seconds. You mentioned cancer as a very big target for this, and good on that front. What other diseases might be potential targets?
Well, Alzheimer's, diabetes, autism, mental illnesses, you name it. That's the beauty of this million cohort study, is that it's not going to focus on any specific disease. It will give us information on almost everything that you would like to know more about.
Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health, thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. Collins. Good luck.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's big push for personalized medicine, genetically targeted, individualized precision therapies, targeted perhaps one day at what ails you, specifically you. Got a couple of people with us who are deep in this. With us from La Jolla, California, Dr. Eric Topol joins us, professor of genomics at the Scripps Research Institute, director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, author of The Patient Will See You Now and the Creative Destruction of Medicine. Dr. Topol, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Dr. Jim Evans, professor of genetics and medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Dr. Evans, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Topol, first to you. I'm looking back here just a year and some ago. There was a company that lots of people heard of called 23andMe, and the whole idea was to lay out your sort of genetic analysis and see what they might learn about your health. And the FDA shut it down because they said it just wasn't clear enough what the value was, or if they were looking at false positives or false negatives, and it wasn't ready for prime time. If that wasn't ready, why are we ready for this initiative now?
Well, Tom, I think that was a big mistake for the FDA to shut 23andMe down. Actually, it was providing a useful service, and it was just getting consumers oriented to their genetics. So it was a nice starter kit. And as you say, Tom, we're moving to the sequencing era, which is much more information about each individual. But there wasn't anything about 23andMe that should have led to a shutdown. And I think this hopefully will get on course, righted in the near term.
I mean, I'm also reading here, and I'm giving you the skeptical stuff first. I want to hear where you think this will go. I'm reading here. This is an op-ed piece in the New York Times. People may have seen it. Michael Joyner wrote it. He's out of Mayo Clinic, of course, great medical center in Minnesota, and he's a real skeptic on this kind of personalized medicine. He's saying, you know, it turns out it just doesn't work that way. And we found that in cancer, you can get way in there, and still it doesn't yield this sort of magical formula that it's like almost like medieval alchemy looking to turn lead into gold. It doesn't exactly. There are too many factors. It doesn't work that way. And we'd be better off focusing on exercise and diet and lifestyle, and we'd end up healthier.
Well, that's a real problem, that nihilistic approach. Sure, we should concentrate on diet and exercise, but that's not enough. We, as both Ron Winslow and Francis Collins nicely articulated, we're in an era now that we can do a Google medical map on each individual, and that rich information can be transformative. We've already seen it for people with undiagnosed diseases, for matching up drugs with the right individual at the right dose. So to negate all the progress that's being made now is really unfortunate.
Dr. Evans, how do you see it? Is this a rich mother lode just waiting to be tapped, or is Dr. Joyner right out of the Mayo Clinic? We should look at environment and culture and behavior before we spend a bunch of money on genetic sequencing and targeting.
Right. Well, I'm sure I fall in between those two viewpoints. I think on one hand, for example, I actually think the FDA did the right thing with shutting down 23andMe, primarily because the claims were tremendously exaggerated. I think on the other hand, it's absurd to not recognize we have a tremendous opportunity right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that President Obama was really beautifully nuanced in how he presented this. One of the things he said was that research pursues dead ends. It is stuttering progress. We can't expect too much too fast. That doesn't mean, though, that we shouldn't seize opportunities. And when I think about it, I think there are a number of short-term opportunities where genomic science and genomic research can benefit the public out there right now. I think, though, that much of the gain that will come from this effort is long-term in things we can't imagine right now and we can't even dream of through simply a better understanding of disease. And I think the trick in communicating this to the public is to walk that line between being too hyped and too exaggerated. It's not going to revolutionize your visit to the doctor anytime soon for most of the people listening, although for some it could, and we can talk more about that later. On the other hand, I think it could revolutionize your children's experience with medicine. And I think we just have to be clear about where are the short-term potentials and where are the long-term potentials.
Dr. Topol, where do you see the earliest possible or likely breakthroughs on this front?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that we're getting data back to the individual. And that's really a new way of going forward. And so this whole notion that it's not just about sequence of people. You've been harping on that, Tom, but it's also about sensors that can collect information, real-time streaming of data to one smartphone. It's about being able to do your
own
smartphone.
You mean not genetic sequencing data, but other data about how the body is performing.
Right, your blood pressure, glucose, heart rhythm, you know, your state of mind, mood, all kind of your lung function for people with asthma. So you have a whole different look now of how medicine's going forward, and that data is going to be flowing directly to the individual. And that's, of course, going back to the point about something like a 23andMe starter kit. People are entitled to get their data. That's the whole thesis of the patient will see you now. And so we are at an exciting juncture, a turning point, or something that I think is unique in our time of medicine, where we're going beyond empowerment, the possibility of really emancipating the consumer to take on much more charge of their care.
Dr. Evans, you could hand me all my data, and it wouldn't mean a lot to me, sadly, not having, you know, the expertise to interpret it. But where do you see the early breakthroughs? What diseases? What fronts?
Yeah. I think your question's precisely the right one. We are in an era of big data, and it's very exciting, including the ability to give people data about themselves. But the trick is, how can we use those data to improve human health, right? I've practiced general medicine for 30 years, genetic medicine for 25 years. And what my patients want, they want more than data. They want to feel better. They want their diseases to go away. They want their suffering to end. And here, I think, are the short-term gains that we can get. And I think that this new initiative will enhance those. Number one, using genomic sequencing, we are now able to make diagnoses we were never able to make before. But that's not going to apply to everyone, right? The MRI is a beautiful machine. It's wonderful. But we don't get MRIs on everybody. We have to learn.
So name some, because you've got millions of listeners saying, well, is it Parkinson's? Is it
exactly.
I've got? Is it this? What?
Exactly.
So what?
Yeah. So if you have a disease that has been resistant to diagnosis and has hallmarks that it may be driven by a genetic process. For example, other people in your family have this unusual disease. If you have something like a birth defect, right? Our bodies are formed by a genetic program. So a large percentage of what have been called birth defects are dictated by genetic.
But you can't go back and fix that, right? Once you're born, you've got it.
That's correct. So that brings up a really important point, which is we have to emphasize that making diagnoses doesn't always mean intervening. It does for some people, and that's why it's critical to make diagnoses. But we should be honest with our patients that making a diagnosis won't always lead to treatment. I think another short-term gain is, as has been mentioned, cancer. I think we will revolutionize how we treat cancer probably over the next 10 to 20 years because of our ability to dissect the genome. And then finally, I think there are some very exciting public health initiatives that could be realized in the short term through genomic investigation.
Let's go to our listeners, Emily in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Emily, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have Philadelphia positive chromosome, CML, it's called, which is a blood cancer.
Okay.
And I've been on targeted therapy for about 7.5 years, almost 8 years now. And basically, it's targeting my genes. And I think with this genetic testing, without the development of some of the drugs now, 3 to 5 years would have been my life expectancy. So I think this is just invaluable that there is this opportunity that we have to look at everybody's genetic makeup, and then maybe even come up with not just something to help me live longer or the people like me with this chronic cancer, but actually to cure it someday.
So you're thinking you wouldn't even be alive if it weren't for personalized medicine already, Emily.
Exactly.
I wish you long and good luck with that. Dr. Topol, what about the span of opportunity in cancer treatment here?
Well, what Emily's presenting is the prototype for everything that we're discussing here today, and that is that exact mutation that caused her leukemia. Now we have targeted therapies, and they are remarkably effective. And the whole notion is to take that to much broader context across all the diseases of man. And I think the chances for that in the years ahead are quite promising.
But what will yield to that kind of insight and what won't? Are you operating on the assumption that if you just understand the genetics and the environmental well enough and how they interact, that a cure is inevitable?
Well, no. In fact, I agree with Jim that this is going to take some time because a lot of cancers, even when you know the exact so-called driver mutation that's causing it, the pathway, you can hit that with a drug that's targeting it. But then 9 months later, there's often a relapse. And then now we have immunotherapy, but we also have the ability to sequence the immune system of each person. So it's going to take time to find the right combinations, but the whole anchoring issue is that this is individualized. What was right for Emily is not going to be right for other people with the same diagnosis. And so this is going to take a while to come up with the right types of treatments. But the beauty of it all, what really makes this so different than the way medicine's been practiced in the past on a mass basis, is that it truly is indexed to each individual.
Diana in Amherst, Massachusetts. Diana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My husband and I both, my late husband and I both had our genomes analyzed using 23andMe.
Before it was sort of shut down, yeah.
They aren't shut down. That's the first thing I'd like to say because they're constantly sending updates on what they're finding out about the data they have from me and my late husband.
Yeah, I shouldn't say shut down, but they really got pushed back from their sort of giant analysis by the FDA. Now they're looking at this one and that one. Okay.
That's right. Anyway, the reason that I did it was that one disease that's very hard to diagnose, it's sort of a disease that doctors come up with by default, is Parkinson's disease. And so I was very interested when they thought my husband might have it, he was older than I, to see whether there was a genetic basis that would help us with that diagnosis. In fact, he did not have any apparent genes that would support a diagnosis of Parkinson's, and I think that was really helpful. He really never developed any further symptoms that would have indicated that's what he would have had, but he might have been started on a drug sooner had we not felt more secure in not doing it as a result of no gene analysis showing it. The other thing that I wanted to say is, even if 23andMe would say that I have a gene for Alzheimer's, that doesn't mean that I'm going to get it. Everything is in context of the overall genome. And, you know, people can live for many, many, many years beyond finding a negative gene without getting the disease. It's very much based on the person and the rest of their genes, as well as that particular gene.
No, all these are so complex. Diana, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Dr. Evans, come in here. There's a comfort and clarity in knowing. But would you feel confident from genetic sequencing or analysis of your genetics today, Dr. Evans, that you, let's say, oh, you probably don't have Parkinson's. Would you trust that today?
No, and it would be crazy to trust that today. And the reason is simply this. The previous caller got it just right. There is tremendous ambiguity and tremendous nuance in the impact of our genome on disease. And the reality is that there are many people who will have a genetic predilection towards Parkinson's disease and never get it. And there are many, many people who will get Parkinson's disease and we can find nothing in their genome that predisposed to it. And the reason's simple is because Parkinson's disease, by and large, is a disease that has many causes, as do most of the diseases that that we are afflicted by. So the trick again is to try to sift through this complex genetic information, which I also feel everyone should have access to. We just need to tell the truth about how good it is. We need to sift through this and find where are the nuggets of things where we can improve both individual health and public health. And there are opportunities to do that. We just have to be smart about identifying them and not hype the whole field and tell everybody that when they go to the doctor next year, it'll be all about their genome.
This seems to a civilian here, a layman, the premise seems sort of to be if you have enough information, voila, we can solve it. What about the ambiguity, the nuance, the things that just can't be sifted out?
Well, the big problem we have is, as been mentioned earlier, is that only a very limited number of people have had a whole genome sequence to this point. And the idea of having a million people sequenced as part of this precision medicine initiative, and by the way, there's several other 100,000 people sequence projects all around the world going on right now. So over the next few years, it's expected that 4 to 5 million people will be sequenced, and a lot of those nuances will get cleared up. Not all by any means, but once we have enough people, millions of people who have been sequenced across all the different conditions and ancestries, we'll be a lot smarter. But one critical point is that none of this information will ever be fatalistic. It's all probabilistic, and that's one of the things we have to adjust to. It's just part of the story, part of the information that each individual will have entitlement to.
Can it be probabilistic instead of fatalistic and set you up for effective treatment? If you're still dealing in probabilities, maybe we dream of too much, hope for too much.
Well, that's the whole notion of prevention. If you know that you have a high risk for heart disease, heart attacks. You may not necessarily get it, but you may take extra precautions, the things that you would do and the treatments that would be worthwhile.
Big new push on for personalized medicine. Dr. Eric Topol, please stand by in La Jolla, California. Dr. Jim Evans in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Imagine having a personal library with over 150,000 titles. Fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable. Now imagine having a personal assistant read them to you in your car, on the train, wherever you want. That's what it's like to have Audible.com. On Point listeners get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint. Download a free title and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's big push for personalized medicine, genetically targeted, individualized, precision therapies targeted perhaps one day at what ails you. The president, happy to talk about it on Friday at the White House, saying bipartisan support here.
The really good news, this is how you know that the moment is right, is there's bipartisan support for the idea here in Washington. Well, which, makes me very happy.
Bipartisan support, that's a pretty rare bird right there. Dr. Eric Topol is with us, professor of genomics at the Scripps Research Institute, joins us from La Jolla, California. Dr. Jim Evans from North Carolina, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Medicine in genetics and medicine there. We're going to talk about measles in a few minutes and what's going on with vaccination and anti-vaccination. Lots of response on personalized medicine. Leah says, I'd rather subsidize healthy organic foods or better outcomes long term. She says, Maverick says, he's not in for this. Sounds like a cover for a way to record everyone's DNA for a national worldwide database. Well, they are looking to get big numbers in there because that's how they can see patterns. What will it mean for you individually? Well, you may have questions. Ustav in New Orleans is calling. Ustav, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
So I'm a medical student from New Orleans, and I'm just thinking more practically. Research advances at a fast pace, but it takes a while for doctors to actually implement those new treatments and really sort of help their patients. It takes, 10, 20 years. There's a lag usually.
Could well, sure.
The question is, what sort of efforts are there being made to advance both the research as well as the training? I mean, it takes 10 to 12 years to train a doctor. How are we, what sort of efforts are being made to incorporate and do these things in tandem?
Ustav, I appreciate your call. Dr. Evans, you're at the medical school there in Chapel Hill. Is this being incorporated into medical training already, or are we waiting on the research results before we go there?
No, it is being incorporated. I think we all recognize that genomics will play an increasing role in medicine. And I think we have to really hit it on two fronts. One is we and others throughout the country are trying to instill in medical students a greater appreciation and understanding for genomics. They have a lot of other stuff to learn too, right? Mm-hmm. But what we also need to do is we need to train physicians who are practicing medicine. Because frankly, most people forget most of what they learned in medical school, which is probably really reassuring to your listeners. And we need to, through professional organizations, for example, like the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, through professional societies, we need to teach physicians what they need to know. We don't need to make them all geneticists, but they need to recognize those opportunities when a patient's sitting in front of them that could actually really benefit from genomic analysis, et cetera.
You're coming back to genomics there as well. Dr. Topol is saying, well, look, it's not just genetics here, folks. What about that balance between monitoring your body's vital signs, your environment, and the genomics piece of this, Dr. Evans?
Yeah, I'm really glad that Eric highlighted that. I think that we can't forget that precision medicine has to include ways of addressing diseases that are tailored to the individual beyond genomics, right? Part of the reason that people get sick in this country is we eat the wrong things. We don't exercise. It's unfortunately been shown that simply providing them their genetic information doesn't have much of an influence on their behavior. No big surprise. But I think that we do need to invest in figuring out how to change behavior, because we can do all the genomics in the world, and if people don't exercise and people don't eat right, we're still going to have big medical problems. And that's not a welcome message, but it's a true message.
Dr. Topol, what about this issue of how humans respond to perceptions of risk? Again, Dr. Michael Joyner writing about this in the New York Times, saying there's evidence that if people feel they're at less risk for a given disease, maybe after their testing, then their behavior gets worse, puts them at a greater risk. Or if they feel they're at a greater risk, even if the increased risk is small, they may become fatalistic and make their behavior worse then, too. Like, the more I know, the human nature is, contrary and odd.
Well, it's quite ill-informed, I'm sorry to say, Tom. In fact, when patients get their data, when they're monitoring their various conditions now, through their smartphone, they're looking at the data, they actually have a tremendous amount of motivation to move to a higher plane of health. So this is just the beginning of this new era, mm-hmm. and sequence is part of it, but also the monitoring and in the context of their own life, not these one-off measurements when you go to a doctor's office.
Let's go to Connie in Augusta, Georgia. Connie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I hope this is an opt-in and not an opt-out situation because, frankly, I want the government to keep its hands off my genetic information. Thank you.
Connie, I appreciate your call. Dr. Topol, what about that long-term? If it becomes the norm to have a whole lot of genetic data on every single person somewhere in a computer so it can be used, we're all very aware of how easily things can be tapped and surveilled and tapped into.
Yes.
That's awfully intimate information.
Well, the caller is absolutely right. This is an opt-in thing. It's not for everybody. Getting all your information or your medical map is not going to be for all people. But for those who want it, it's going to be an extraordinary opportunity. But the privacy and security is paramount. We are not well prepared to deal with that right now. Hopefully, that can get on track. But one thing to underscore, Tom, mm-hmm. is that let's say you have cancer, and then there's this global information knowledge resource, and you want to match up your cancer, your biologic pathway with that, millions of other people with the matching up the treatment outcomes.
Mm. Yep.
So that person that opted out may all of a sudden want to opt in to get the best treatment.
If it becomes the norm, Dr. Evans, that everybody gets mapped so that you can be treated, it's the norm of medicine. Can you see that being kept adequately private? What's the risk there?
Well, I've always liked the quote by Scott McNeely, who I believe founded Sun Microsystems. He said, privacy is dead. Deal with it, right? And while that sounds a little bit cynical, I think we're in an era where privacy has been compromised in ways that we couldn't have dreamt of 20 years ago. What we have to do is we have to deal with it. We have to figure out ways of making sure that information isn't misused. I think the fact that this is opt-in is very important because there are some people who simply don't want it. The good thing that I would say is that right now I'd far rather give my entire genome sequence to the 2 million listeners mm-hmm. of this radio station mm-hmm. than my social security number. I don't think that I'm very sensitive to the fact that people should be able to keep this information as private as possible. We have to remember that going forward. We have to make it difficult to misuse the information. But we also have to share it to a large extent or we'll never figure out what's going on with it. And we have to have penalties in place that penalize the misuse of it and incentives that incentivize using it correctly.
Let's get one more question from a listener, very specific, but that's illustrative maybe. Kevin in Charleston, South Carolina. Kevin, you're on.
Yes, I was diagnosed with alopecia about 7 years ago.
This is the hair loss autoimmune disease, okay?
Loss autoimmunity, yes.
Okay.
And I was curious, too, whether what they were speaking of is, would that help entail figure out how to cure that and what would go about to get it figured out?
Okay, Kevin, thank you. Dr. Topol, Kevin's hair is falling out, alopecia. When are you going to get to race in there and change it and save his hair?
I think that's going to be relatively imminent in the next few years because there's been a lot of great genomics research in that condition, and I think it's ripe for some good interventions based on that new information.
What's your guess about the general horizon here, Dr. Topol? Pick a year when we'll look back and say, wow, we are in a new era. Our medicine is so much more precise and targeted now than it was X years ago. Are we talking 2020, 2030, 2040?
Well, it's not going to be an on-off switch. It's much more going to be a wavefront of gradual. But it's not going to just be, as we've emphasized, with sequence. Mm-hmm. I do think that this initiative that was announced is going to help it, but a lot more work is going to be done. But I do think that, when we get to 2020, medicine will be unrecognizable as compared to as it is today.
That is not so very far away. Kevin, hang on to your hair. Maybe sooner than that for alopecia, but for a Title change, 2020 doesn't sound so very far. Dr. Eric Topol at Scripps Research Institute, thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Eric Topol joining us from La Jolla, California. And Dr. Jim Evans and in Chapel Hill. Dr. Evans, thanks to you.
Thank you.
In a moment, we will hear the latest on the spread of measles here in the United States. This is On Point. In the year 2000, measles were announced gone from the United States. They're back now with a vengeance. Since the start of the year, the CDC has confirmed 84 cases of measles in 14 states. The heart of the outbreak, Disneyland. And one group now getting a lot of skeptical attention, families that do not vaccinate their children for measles. With me now from Denver, Colorado, is Jack Healy, correspondent for the New York Times. His recent report is headlined, Vaccine Critics Turn Defensive Over Measles. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack, thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tom.
What's the evidence you're finding of this anti-vaxxer crowd being on the defense?
Well, I mean, I think there is as these cases spread, I think there's sort of a growing chorus of criticism of parents' decisions not to vaccinate their kids and, you know, the recommendations from some health providers. I would think a very slender few, but the sort of, you know, naturopathic side of the health community who has, you know, backed up some of their decisions. The CDC is tracked, I think, about 102 cases, according to figures, and it's raised some concerns about, you know, the fact that, you know, this disease is now being spread, you know, due to the fact that people have these somewhat baseless fears and suspicions over vaccines, because as you had pointed out, measles was all but a thing of the past just a few years ago.
What are the prospects now? When you get to 102 cases in a country the size of the United States, with the portion of our population that is not now vaccinated, is it inevitable that we're going to go up to 1,000, 10,000, I don't know what, or is it still manageable?
I really have no idea where the numbers could go. It's more of a question for an epidemiologist. The U.S. still has a pretty high vaccination rate. I mean, about 92%, I believe, of the entire population is vaccinated. You know, most medical folks say that you need about 90 to 95% for what, you know, they refer to as herd immunity to, you know, keep diseases kind of like measles from being passed around. But the problem is that there are, you know, as you get these outbreaks, there are people who are sort of susceptible because they can't be vaccinated, because they're infants who are too young to get their vaccinations. I talked with a mom whose kid had a heart transplant and whose immune system is incredibly compromised because of that. And, you know, she doesn't have the ability to give her six-year-old daughter vaccines, and so she's terrified. You know, she's a California mom, and so she's terrified of, you know, her kid getting this at school or, you know, from neighbors, that sort of thing.
Medical people talk about herd immunity. And now we don't think of ourselves as a herd, but in a way we are. And are you saying then that at 92% immunization rate, we're still within sort of the realm of herd immunity? Then why is it spreading?
Well, you're getting a lot of people in places like California who simply haven't vaccinated their kids. And I think Thomas Friedman of the CDC was talking about this the other day on one of the Sunday shows. They've just seen these groups of people who have made the decision either because they have concerns about these sort of discredited reports linking vaccines to autism or autoimmune diseases or concerns about heavy metals or things like that in the vaccines. They've chosen not to vaccinate their kids, or they're stretching out the timetable of vaccinations. And so they're creating these populations who are extremely susceptible to getting these diseases.
Are those studies discredited, Jack?
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but every doctor that I've talked to about this has said that vaccines are safe. They are effective, and they vaccinate their own children.
The head of the CDC, as you say, the director there, Thomas Friedman, warning over the weekend, this was on Face the Nation, of a large outbreak of measles that could result in this country.
We are very concerned by the growing number of people who are susceptible to measles and to the possibility that we could have a large outbreak in this country as a result.
Susceptible very widely now because they're just not vaccinated. Here's Frieden again.
We can control it. The future is within our control. If we vaccinate well, if we increase those vaccination rates, we can stop measles just as we stopped it before.
Jack Healy, are the non-vaccinated, unvaccinated populations in this country spread out sort of evenly all over the place, or are there pockets that are more vulnerable to measles right now?
Yeah, there are pockets. I mean, and this is one of the things where there's, I think, an intersection of law and culture at play here. You have places in parts of, for example, California, where I was over the weekend, where there are some small private schools, like some Montessori's or religious schools or Waldorf schools, where maybe half of the kids are unvaccinated due to parents requesting personal belief exemptions from the requirements that their kids be vaccinated to attend school. But like across the state of California, even though there's this big measles outbreak there, about 90% or so of the state is vaccinated. And, you know, most public school kids are also vaccinated. You have big variations in laws from state to state. Some states like California have what critics say are pretty lenient exemption requirements. You know, you can just say, I don't believe in this and therefore, my kid doesn't need to get this. You have other states like Mississippi or West Virginia where the laws are a lot tighter, and it's a lot harder for parents who might not want to get their kids vaccinated to actually claim an exemption. So there is a, you know, the state laws actually play a big role in this thing.
Given the kind of concern that the CDC director was articulating there, Jack, is there talk now of tightening up those exception requirements, making it less easy to avoid the vaccination?
Yeah, I mean, California a couple of years ago tried to do that exact same thing. Washington State, I believe, has also passed a tighter law. And there are doctors, you know, who are watching this happen, who are certainly urging legislators to take up the matter, you know, and to try to force as many parents as possible to, you know, get their kids vaccinated.
Measles in the United States soaring to 644 cases last year, on track to be well ahead of that this year. Jack Healy with the New York Times. Thank you very much for joining us today, Jack.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Listeners, good luck. Thank you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.